if the government today, with the policies that they've come out with, wants to basically create the revolution and not the evolution, then I think you're going to see a lot of capital sit on the sidelines and projects not get done. So I think the government has to be realistic about how we evolve into becoming a lot more green.
Welcome to the Great Green Upgrade. I'm Jacob Sussman, CEO of Ambient Fuels. I'm joined by Mark Behrman, CEO of LSB Industries, a leading North American producer of industrial and agricultural chemicals. In this episode, we'll be focused on ammonia. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Jake. How are you?
Doing great today. How about yourself?
Everything's great. Glad to be
awesome.
Here.
Awesome. Great to hear. Well, before we get started, Mark, tell us about your journey. How does a New York guy who spent 15 plus years as a Wall Street banker end up running an agricultural chemicals company in Oklahoma City?
Yeah, it's been an interesting ride. So you're right. I did spend over 25 years as a banker, primarily covering the industrial space, which included chemicals. LSB was a small client of mine, got introduced by a friend to the founder and chairman and CEO at the time. And they had a couple of interesting businesses, including this nitrogen chemical business, but they also had another main business, which was a manufacturer of HVAC products, really specialty HVAC products, including heat pumps, believe it or not, which are really relevant in today's environment. So I helped them out with a few small advisory assignments, got to know them more as friends than anything else. The founder had an aging management team and determined that, rightly so, that it was time to really probably have a bring in some new blood and some fresh pair of eyes. And the company had gotten much larger over the years than when I first met them. And they enticed me to move from New York to Oklahoma City, initially with the idea that I would become chief financial officer within a year of joining the company. And then that morphed into a quasi-COO role and culminated at the end of 18 with the board asking me if I would step into the CEO role. So it's been an interesting run. It'll actually be 10 years for me next month. And I was asked just a couple of weeks ago, so how do I think about my 10-year run? And it's really kind of 2 5-year increments, pre-CEO and post-CEO. So very different. People still refer to me even internally here as, financial guy or an ex-banker. But I would say after 10 years of being at the company, I think I'm more an operational guy today than a banker.
Yeah. It's amazing how our life journeys take us to different places and move us through different phases, both personal and professional.
Yeah.
And what about the transition from New York to Oklahoma City? That's a little bit of a change, right?
It was. They started, the management team here at LSB started asking me if I would move to Oklahoma City about 5 years before I decided to do that. But we had kids in high school and probably not, I think my wife and I thought better of taking kids out of high school in New York and putting them in Oklahoma City. We wanted to have a continuing relationship with them. So they would ask every year, is now the time, is now the time? And I would tell you that the founder was, had a lot of perseverance in anything he did. So as I said, we got to know each other personally. So I have two kids. When we dropped off our youngest to college, he called my wife actually and said he wanted to talk to her about, how was it and dropped off your daughter, and I'm sure it was emotional, different than a son, all of that. Then it was put Mark on the phone. So we never really thought that we would do this. But one thing led to another. We took a trip out here. We liked it. And it was just the two of us because the kids were off to college. And we decided to make a change. And it's been great. We love Oklahoma City. And it's blossomed in the 10 years that we've been here. And now the 20th largest city in the country. So it's been a great experience.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I had a couple great dinners there at Mickey Mantle's over the years, and the whole kind of Bricktown area is fun to mess around down there. Well, awesome. And in your company's sort of, website and in some of the other presentations I've seen you make, you talk a lot about being a key player in the energy transition. How did you come to that? I mean, it's a relatively new concept. And, you know, where does that fit into your business today?
Yeah, so it started out, believe it or not, as what I'll call a skunk works project. You know, like, what is this, you know, burgeoning conversation that's out there about hydrogen and ammonia and, you know, low carbon and no carbon and blue and green and then turquoise and all different colors. And so I started looking at it, you know, myself, really, in 2019. And it really probably accelerated during 2020 when COVID hit. Lots of time on our hands. We all had that. And everyone was connecting on Zoom and Teams, and you can get to people around the world, and a lot of announcements of MOUs and different projects. And so I became really just more curious and really gathering and learning information. And, you know, what I found initially was, you know, lots of discussion about demand and lots of announcements of plants that wanted to be built. But, you know, when you start talking to folks about, so how do you think about running an ammonia plant? And especially when we started out talking really green, so that's zero carbon, right? So how do you really run that? And it's really using electrolyzers to split the hydrogen out of water and then taking nitrogen from the air and feeding it into an ammonia synthesis loop. But the key to any chemical or petrochemical company, or even down to the plant level, the economics are such that the first 70-75% of production generally is going to cover your fixed costs. And then after that is really where you make your margin. So initially when I started talking to folks, it was, we're going to run these electrolyzers, you know, and produce maybe 60% of the time. And it's like, I'm not sure how you're going to make money doing that. I mean, you'll have to charge such high price for a ton of ammonia that I don't think it's feasible. I don't think anyone's going to pay that. So then it was, you know, start thinking about, well, who's going to run these plants and what technical expertise do you have? And initially, I really was kind of surprised. It was, well, that's the easy part. And it's like, no, that's really the hard part. Is it's not easy to run ammonia plants. They're kind of temperamental. So, you know, I sat back and really thought about, okay, well, what could we do? We run ammonia plants today. And the initial thought was, okay, well, we could modify one of our smaller ammonia plants to allow us to feed into the synthesis loop green ammonia, zero carbon ammonia made through electrolyzers, so that when renewable power was running, we could use that. And when it wasn't, we'll just, make ammonia the conventional way using natural gas. So then we started having a discussion internally. So one thing led to another, right? We became more committed to it. We looked at carbon capture. We developed actually a carbon capture project at our largest facility, which we're in the middle of, to make blue ammonia. And we then made some commitment to hire a head of clean energy that would focus on it. It wasn't just my little project on the side anymore. And then as things evolved, you know, we developed a number of different projects, and we think actually, and we started really thinking maybe 6 to 12 months ago about, so how do we think about our current business and what do we think about the opportunities for, low carbon and no carbon ammonia out there? And so actually our vision has changed now. So today we want to be a leading producer of low carbon products that feed, power, and support the world. And so I think we're in a journey now where we expect to really transition our company to be a leading provider of low carbon products.
I love that. So I think my takeaway from that, Mark, is you got a little taste of what the kind of lower carbon or decarbonization path might look like. And it sounds like you got enough feedback from your stakeholders that you decided to just keep going with it and really work it into the company's broader strategy.
Everything that we do, right? we've got shareholders just like, you know, any other company. And so you have to do it economically, right? It's got to make sense. So to just build facilities to be part of the energy transition and not make the right return on investment of capital, there's no point in really doing that, right? So our shareholders expect us to invest capital wisely and to create higher returns for them and, you know, obviously increase our shareholder value just across the board. And so I think we are thinking about and came up with ways that we think can add value to our shareholders, of which we're all large shareholders.
Yeah, great. All right, so let's pull back the frame a little bit for some of our viewers who may not be as familiar with the sector. So what role does ammonia play in the world food supply, and how is ammonia generally produced around the world today?
Sure. So I'll start with the production, right? So today, the conventional method of producing ammonia, which today most people call gray ammonia, is through the use of natural gas. So nitrogen from the air, hydrogen from natural gas, right? You strip it out of the methane and natural gas, feed it into the front end of a plant. It gets synthesized through a number of different steps. CO2 is generated. If you're not capturing it, you're venting it in the air, and out comes ammonia. So it's really, ammonia is NH3, so nitrogen, three hydrogen molecules, and you know, you've got ammonia. Most, about 180 million tons a year are produced globally, of which 70 to 80% is used for fertilizer. The rest are used for industrial applications. So when you think about fertilizer, I think the thing that astonishes people when you talk about just generally fertilizers as a whole, but then more specifically nitrogen fertilizers, they're used to produce food, right, in the food supply. And so there's a lot of studies that have been done over the last 5 to 10 years as people have talked about, well, we got to get rid of synthetic fertilizers and things like that. Well, what would that do to the world? Well, there's about 8 million people on the planet today. And if we got rid of synthetic nitrogen fertilizers, studies show that about half of those people would not survive. So we've been able to handle the population growth across the globe by utilizing synthetic fertilizers, nitrogen fertilizer, to really get better yields out of our crops, have more resilient crops, and just have food in general for folks to eat.
Thanks for walking us through that. And you mentioned the CO2 that comes out of the process. Order of magnitude, how much does that go down when you capture the CO2 through blue hydrogen? And obviously, I guess it goes down the rest of the way if you go to all the way to green.
Yeah. So again, it's kind of interesting. I said it really started out with colors, right? And we're talking about blue and green, but I think, as you know, probably the colors need to go out the window. It's all about the carbon intensity score, right? But for simplicity purposes, we can talk about blue being low carbon and green being zero carbon, right? So in a traditional ammonia plant, and most ammonia plants, we use something called an SMR, a steam methane reformer. There is another technology that's becoming more popular called ATR, which is an autothermal reactor, but let's stick with the SMR, which is what we have on all three of our plants today and how we make ammonia. CO2 is produced in two different areas there. It's during the process, and it's also flue gas. So when you really take a step back, what's economical to capture today is about 60% of the CO2 using an SMR. It's not that you can't capture the other 40%. It'd just be really uneconomical. But there are a lot of technologies that people are working on that are being developed that ultimately will allow us to capture that 40%. But today, 60%, so usually there's about 2 tons of CO2 produced for every ton of ammonia. So you can capture, again, about one, if it's 2 tons, so about 1.2 tons of CO2 for every ton of ammonia can be captured today. ATR technology allows you to capture 95 plus percent just because of the difference in the process. So what you're seeing is there's a lot of announcements of big brand new ammonia plants, particularly here in the U.S. Gulf. And most of those are being built with ATRs rather than SMRs because you can capture a majority of the CO2.
And so it sounds like some of this is going to come down to how confident you are you'll be able to capture that, you know, 60 or eventually 95%, and then keep it under the ground. Are there sort of differing opinions on that at all, or is it all sort of kind of figured out at this point?
Well, I think, you know, in order to permanently put away CO2, it's called sequestration, yep. And you need to have the right geology to do that. So typically you're going to compress and liquefy the CO2 and then inject it in a well into the ground. And you need a large saline formation down there to do that. So the geology plays a big role in making sure you've got the right capability to sequester it. And of course, then there are proven methods to inject it down, store it there, and monitor it to make sure that it's not coming up out of the ground. And there's different casings that you can put on. So that's, I think that's a given. But, you know, where you sequester, the economics of that, how much of a pipeline you need from the emissions point or source, right? So the ammonia plant to where you're going to sequester it, pipelines are expensive. So, you know, again, all of that comes into play on capital cost and what kind of return you can get by doing it.
Let's move over to the green hydrogen side of the equation. And your company's been a leader in both blue and green, which is terrific. I know we're not using the colors anymore. But first of all, do you agree with the statement that the flywheel hasn't really gotten going yet in the green industry? And if that's the case, you know, what do you see as some of the barriers to really getting that wheel spinning?
Well, here in the U.S., we've got the Inflation Reduction Act that has created a lot of incentives for the investment and production of green hydrogen and green ammonia. So I think, first off, it's taken us a while here in the States to really, it's taken the government a while to really figure out, okay, we've got these incentives of $3 tax credit of $3 or up to $3 per kilogram of hydrogen, green hydrogen produced, right? But it's great to have a high level incentive program, but practically speaking, what do you need to do in order to meet that and to get that tax credit, and how does it get implemented? And so we've had a number of delays by the government in really coming out with those programs, which they did recently and were quite different than what people were led to believe. So I think clear government policy, one way or the other, is certainly needed, because people are sitting on the sidelines waiting for clarification and a lot of clarity. If the government today, with the policies that they've come out with, wants to basically create the revolution and not the evolution, then I think you're going to see a lot of capital sit on the sidelines and projects not get done. So I think the government has to be realistic about how we evolve into becoming a lot more green. And so there's a number of different, you know, qualifications that you would have to meet, including hourly matching, which is obviously a big deal for a lot of people. And so I understand where the government wants to go with this, and it makes sense, but I think you have to ease into it rather than having this, you know, day one revolution, as I think about it. The other thing that I think is really important, yeah, particularly here in the United States, is we're talking about new demand, and a lot of this new demand, they're talking about green hydrogen to green ammonia, and it's going, you know, it's getting exported, and it's going overseas, and it's going to Europe to help decarbonize Europe, and it's going to Asia to help decarbonize Asia, or at least that's the plans. I would like to see an incentive program here to create demand, So normalize pricing, like a lot of the other countries, and particularly the Asian countries, are really utilizing their incentive programs to stimulate and create that demand. Because, Jake, you and I sat on a panel a year and a half ago or so, and I think I was called a naysayer, which is fine. But
not by me.
Not by you. But the reality is, sure, there's a lot of capital out there, and people can build a lot of supply. But if you don't have customers on the other end, then we're not going anywhere. So ultimately, we have to have people that want to buy the product at a price that economically makes sense for the investment of capital. And so I think the government could help in that respect and maybe cap some of the incentives, because today there's a program in the IRA that's out there that is uncapped. And, if you meet the qualifications and you construct during these periods of time, you'll qualify for the incentives. Maybe there's a capping of that and a reallocation of some of the dollars to create and stimulate demand.
That's really helpful to put it in that context. So I hear you saying to get the flywheel going, we need clear and timely guidance from the government on what the incentives are going to be. Government's got to take a realistic view on how to kind of make this transition. And I'll put in a plug for some transitional period where you can live with annual matching as you move to hourly under Section 45V of the IRA. And then I think I also heard you say, Mark, we just need more demand creation. And some of that, hopefully can also come from the government in the form, for example, of maybe the OECD has a program out of their hubs initiative for about $1 billion worth of demand creation. We need more programs like that in order to kind of spur these consumers to action.
Totally agree.
Yeah. And speaking of the consumers, what have you seen specifically in terms of willingness to pay a premium for low or zero carbon ammonia?
Well, I've had a lot of really good conversations globally about low-carbon ammonia, because quite frankly, the price of low-carbon ammonia is going to be lower than the price of zero-carbon ammonia, right? Just based on the pure economics. So a lot of really interesting opportunities in Asia, and in particularly in Japan and in South Korea. They're really thinking about decarbonizing through less use of coal to produce power, and increasing or combining ammonia with coal to create a cleaner, power source. So there's a utility, largest utility in Japan called JERA. JERA is actually has done a bunch of testing co-firing coal and ammonia. They're running a test next month, I believe, to actually the test will be for 30 days in a row, where they're going to use 20% ammonia as a fuel source and 80% coal rather than 100% coal, proving out that it works and there are no kinks within that system. And I think everyone will feel a lot more comfortable there, right? So Japan and South Korea are looking at it the same way. They've got incentive programs that they've got in place, but really they're trying to formalize their incentive programs as well and how you meet those qualifications, different types of programs and schemes. We've had some really good conversations with some potential European buyers. And really, Europe, I think, started out thinking we're going to go from, a hydrocarbon world to a green world. And again, that revolution. And I think, after maybe a couple of years, maybe it softened a little bit on making that transition. And so what's driving Europe? Certainly they want to decarbonize, but also Europe's taken a bit of a different tact, right? So here in the States, we've got incentive programs. In Europe, they've got some incentive programs, but they've also got a CBAM tax that's coming. So what does that mean? That means if you are not importing or using a low-carbon product, it's going to cost you more to buy that carbonized product. So that's driving a lot of incentive to spur demand. And so I think we're having a lot of really good conversations there. Here in the States, it's a bit different, and it gets back to some of the conversation we had earlier about creating that demand. We've had some good conversations about some niche applications and niche uses, niche demand for green ammonia, for zero carbon ammonia. But I think that's, in the United States, at least my thought process today is we're going to start with smaller, nichier applications and smaller, nichier demand than big power producers that want hundreds of thousands of tons of product. It may be 5,000 or 10,000 or even 30,000 tons of demand by a particular customer here. So I think it's going to, without that incentive program to spur demand here, I think it's going to start out, with applications that can afford to pay, a much higher price for ammonia.
And in those nichier areas, either here or abroad, give us a sense of the range of premium you think people might be willing to pay.
Maybe $400, $300 to $400 above where ammonia trades at today.
All right. That's significant. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
But, again, does that support building, scale electrolyzer, electrolyzer plants that then feed the green hydrogen into an ammonia plant? And, probably not. And that's part of the problem, right? The economics make sense. Scale matters.
And that's where I was going to go next is, you've been an early adopter with both blue and green ammonia production strategies. What motivated you to do so? It sounds like not all premium that you're, seeing in the market today. So what were some of the other drivers? What does it take for an early adopter like yourself to sort of lock in?
Well, I think any project we do, we've got to have a majority of the production from that project and offtake, right? I mean, I think we can create lots of really good spreadsheets that the economics look really good, but when it comes down to it, and we're writing checks to invest capital to build new assets and plants, and you've got to have customers on the other end who are committed to paying the price that create the right returns, right? So for us, I think it's finding it's spending capital to develop an opportunity or an idea. But before we would go certainly to FID, right, to final investment decision, we've got to have committed offtake. I think, part of the question you asked me is why early adopter or first adopter? Because we think that there's value to being first in the marketplace. I'm old enough to have seen a number of different marketplaces develop. And I think if you're early on, and an earlier adopter, early entrant into the marketplace, you definitely have better opportunities than being a second or third mover where many of the better opportunities are taken.
Words to live by beyond just in the green ammonia sector, for sure.
Yeah.
So let's also talk about kind of the international perspective and where you expect green hydrogen or its derivatives like green ammonia to be most competitive. We have this ongoing process to figure out what the 45V guidelines will actually mean in terms of our incentives. It's pretty meaningful, the impact that whether you have hourly matching versus annual matching will have on our cost of production. Can the U.S., win the global hydrogen foot race if we end up with that hourly matching as it's currently written? Do you see sort of other markets, maybe Europe, maybe Asia, being able to produce at par or even cheaper than us potentially? Give us a sense for which of the markets you think are leading, at least as of today.
Well, certainly, going back to the colors, blue ammonia, we're probably in the U.S., we're probably a leader in blue ammonia. And I'd say that there's a few reasons for that. One is when you look around the world, we don't have the cheapest cost for natural gas. It's pretty darn cheap. So, you know, relatively speaking, versus Europe or Asia or even South America, you know, Europe and Asia are generally using LNG, which is going to be a lot more expensive than our natural gas here. And you can just look at the, you know, listed prices out in the marketplace. So cheap cost of feedstock, right, to generate and to produce that ammonia, incentives to sequester the CO2, good political system, easy to do business in the United States. And I only bring those things up, and it's not, you know, really a comparison one versus another, but, you know, Middle East has basically free natural gas, right? So that natural gas is really coming out with all the oil production.
It's a co-product with the oil, right?
It is. If they're going to Asia, their cost of freight is probably a little bit less than coming out of the U.S. Gulf. But as we've seen recently, with shipping lanes having issues and canals, you know, having issues, and you know, I think that that whole political climate and ease of doing business in the U.S. Trumps something like the Middle East. Outside of the Middle East and the U.S., you know, producing low carbon blue ammonia is probably not as economical in other places. And if you look at the Europe trying to produce, if they could sequester and produce blue ammonia, you know, there's a cost to take it from the Gulf to Europe, but that cost is less than the differential in what it would take on natural gas prices. So I think it's a great place, and the U.S. is very focused on low-carbon ammonia today. As far as green or zero-carbon hydrogen or ammonia, I think we can be cost competitive. What drives the bulk of the cost in running electrolyzers that are needed to produce green product, and that's power. And so I think the U.S. power prices, you know, if you look around the world, are ultra competitive to a lot of other places. And so I think from just a pure cost perspective, again, I think we can be really competitive, and then you've got to normalize for freight. And so that,
you know, it's
be
interesting. At the same time, you have these electrolyzer manufacturers really growing rapidly over in China, and you know, China's going to make a run at this industry, the green hydrogen industry, I believe.
Sure.
And it just feels very consequential to me if we set our policies up so that we can only run our electrolyzers 60% of the hours. Versus if we get the legislation right and the guidance right under 45E and are able to run them at something closer to 100%, feels like in that scenario we'd have a fighting chance of winning the, you know, the electrolyzer arms race and really getting some of that manufacturing to happen here in the U.S.
Yeah, I agree. I think policy is going to dictate whether we can really be competitive or not.
Yeah, for sure. Well, all right. I have a friend, believe it or not, his business card says he's a futurist. All right. So put on your futurist hat for a second and think about some of the other ways in the future that we might be using low or zero carbon ammonia. Give us a few of those that you think we could be coming down the road.
Well, the obvious one that's most talked about is as a marine transportation fuel. So marine industry today, you know, based on the fuels that they use, emits a lot of CO2, dirty fuel really used to fuel ocean-going vessels. So big push in the marine industry to focus on low-carbon, zero-carbon fuels, methanol and ammonia being the two primary that they're looking at. And so, you know, there'd probably be a little bit of a race on whether it's methanol or ammonia, although lots of studies on carbon intensity and emissions from burning those particular products. And there's no doubt that zero carbon ammonia has the lowest carbon intensity. So I think ultimately, if we can get there, that's where we evolved to. You know, in the U.S., got a lot of tugboats going up and down the river systems. Again, really dirty fuel. So there's an opportunity there if we can be cost competitive and not be cost prohibitive. And I think that's really the key. Look, ultimately, whether it's industrial applications like forklifts, like other type of transportation vehicles, you know, Walmart trucks or whatever it's going to be, that's more hydrogen-based than it's going to be ammonia-based. But again, could you use ammonia as a carrier? Does it make sense? And then what we call de-crack the hydrogen out of the ammonia? Sure, do we build smaller hydrogen hubs? You know, in locations where you've got within 100 or 200 mile radius, you know, a lot of customers that would be users. So maybe that hub and spoke in the U.S. is going to make a lot of sense for us. But I do think that there are a lot of industrial applications that will use either low carbon or zero carbon hydrogen and ammonia.
I think you might do pretty well as a futurist yourself, Mark. So this has been a great conversation. I've learned a lot and appreciate your kind of explaining in a really practical, easy to understand way kind of how all these sector dynamics work. Is there a final concluding thought you'd want to leave the listeners with just about low carbon and zero carbon hydrogen and ammonia and where they're heading?
Well, I guess I would even go, you know, maybe one step above that, right? I mean, I've been through, I call it a couple of green waves, right? Where people were really interested in alternative energy and ways that they, you know, consumer was really interested in ways that they could reduce their heating costs or cooling costs in their homes and things like that. And so yeah, I mentioned earlier heat pumps. I mean, heat pumps were back in 2006, 7, 8, 9 timeframe. And that business really took off because natural gas prices were $5, $6. Of course, natural gas prices with the evolution of fracking came down in price. And so people didn't really care about it as much. But today, I think it's very different. And so when you look at the landscape of greening and decarbonizing, you've got many governments around the world that are creating incentive programs or some type of scheme to incentivize the reduction of CO2. You've got a lot of private capital that really want to invest in the energy transition and reducing CO2 emissions. And then I think the biggest thing is you've got consumers who are really supportive of it. And I just use my kids as an example. They're 32 and 29 years old. And when I talk to them about, you know, you're aware of this, you're aware of climate change and all of this, like, you know, would you pay more for an end product if it was CO2 light or CO2 free? And the answer is yes. And you talk to their friends and the answer is yes. As long as it's not cost prohibitive, you know, yeah, we want a cleaner world. We want a better environment for our kids and our kids' kids. And so I'm confident that this is not going away. Now, how it unfolds, I think the story is yet to be written, right? I mean, we both know you can have the greatest roadmap and, you know, it's going to change 50 times until you get to sort of the end point, right? So I think ultimately hydrogen and ammonia have a real significant place in our global economy. And I think that there's a lot of opportunities that we can use them to decarbonize. We just have to find the right opportunities. And again, we've got to match supply to demand.
Well, Mark, it's very encouraging to hear somebody who's spent time in both conventional and clean energy circles to bring it down to that very basic level of what human beings and our kids want to have in the products that they use and the things that they do with their life. So I tend to agree and really appreciate your joining us here on the Great Green Upgrade. Is there a good place for folks to find you? Maybe on your company's website or LinkedIn or something to that end?
Yeah, I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. So I'm pretty passionate about our business and where we're going. So people can follow me on LinkedIn. Also, company website is out there. And then, I have a colleague, Jacob Krumenacher, who leads our clean energy practice. And Jacob is a frequent speaker at a lot of conferences. So I would encourage you guys to go out and listen to him. And he's got a lot of really interesting views on this whole marketplace and also how it's going to unfold.
Super. Jacob's the best. So we'll look for him there. We will keep following you. And again, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Jake. Have a great day.
That's it for this episode of The Great Green Upgrade. You can see more about the work we do at Ambient Fuels at ambientfuels.com. I'm Jacob Sussman. Thanks for being with us today.